Okay, Ta. Right, let's carry on a little bit now. You can help refresh my memory. Let's talk about some of the projects we worked on together, Steve. One of the ones I particularly remember was the 18 meganewton or 1800 ton aluminium plate stretcher for a company called Slasim in France. And the destination, I seem to recall, was Nag Hammadi in Egypt. What can you recall about that, Steve?
Well, up to that point, I'd really been working on concrete presses, as I'd said, and a few other projects. But this was a very, very interesting project. As you say, it ended up in Egypt. I think it's near the Aswan Dam, and it was to do with that project. And I remember seeing the layout of the factory and showing our stretcher, that though it's 450 tons and a very large machine, the biggest machine I'd ever seen, it was tiny within their factory. It was a dot in the corner. So it was a massive project.
So that machine weighed 450 tons then. Perhaps we ought to just mention at this stage that the purpose of a plate stretching machine was to stretch aluminium plates beyond their elastic limit, about 4%, and it gave the plate a kind of a stress relieving operation, so all the molecules were aligned together rather than being higgledy-piggledy all over the place, and it made the material much more stable, so when any machining was necessary, distortion was at a minimum. Right then, Steve, so these plate sizes, they were used. These were the maximum sizes that were done on the stretched on the machine.
Yes. You had the maximum size was 12,500 millimeters by that was the length, 2,100 millimeters wide, and it was 30 thick, and the maximum force that the machine could generate was 1,800 tons. I remember the crossheads. I did the drawings, some hand drawings actually, of the two big castings, the two jaws, and if I remember right, they weighed approximately 90 tons fully assembled. That was the cylinder end and the tail end crosshead.
Okay, now I seem to recall that I went with Leslie Spooner over to France. I just cannot remember what part of France we went to. I met the customer, and I was actually there when Mr. Spooner shook hands with his counterpart that we'd obtained the order. So that was a first for me. But that was as far as it went. I never went to France again on that project, and I don't think you did either, did you, Steve?
No, I didn't. No, I was still doing my apprenticeship really at the beginning of that project. So no, I certainly didn't go. The one thing I do remember is hearing the story of Les Spooner getting himself locked in, I think it was the hotel car park.
I well remember that, and he's denied it ever since. Were there any, can you recall any particularly challenging parts we had about that, Steve? Any parts of the design? Just refresh my memory.
The plate breakage issues were always very challenging, and it was new to me, and it was something that you did a lot of work on, John, and I worked with you and was interested to learn. But yes, that was a challenging part, as it is with all plate stretchers.
Yeah, you virtually got to design them. You got to design the machine to break a plate rather than just to stretch it.
Yes.
Okay, so we've heard a little bit about that one. But I understand that eventually the CAD system was replaced by something called Pro Engineer. Can you explain a little bit about that to me, Steve?
Yes. So I think this was about 1996. We'd been using ME10 up to that point, which was 2D CAD, which was a drawing board on a computer screen, if you like. But then it was decided that the company should invest in 3D CAD, which is still very much in use today and is probably the primary way in which people design in our industry today. So ProEngineer was a 3D CAD system, quite an expensive system at that time, where you create the components on the screen in the computer almost as if you were manufacturing them. So you would extrude a shape, you would cut material from that shape, you put a hole through it as if you drill a hole through it. So you almost manufacture all the components within the computer, and then you build them into assemblies just like you would have done down the workshop. And then using that CAD system, you can see if you have interferences, you can play about with the design. It's also very easy to envisage the design because you're able to spin the model and look at it from all angles, turn bits off. One thing that I know even today people are interested by, though it's a very simple thing, you can get the weight of a machine very quickly. You just press a button and the computer calculates the weight of the machine, where I was even used to doing it by hand, where you had to break the components down into shapes that you could calculate volumes, calculate weights, and then add it all up. So to calculate the weight of, say, the Klesheim stretcher, which was around 450 tons, that took a lot of calculations to come to that. To calculate the weight of equipment which we designed on ProEngineer took a matter of seconds.
Obviously, very advantageous from a time-saving point of view. Steve, coming on to up to the time when I was sort of looking ahead of 8 or 10 months to retirement, we worked on the final project together. And as I recall, that was a monster. That was a 15,000-ton plate stretcher for Pechenet-Renelieu in France. Now, Pechenet-Renelieu were originally Segedor, where we'd installed a stretcher back in 1963, which was used to help form some of the components used on Concorde. It was a design study that we did. Unfortunately, an order was never placed, but at least the design stage was completed. And there were a fair number of challenges there, because the sizes were pretty monstrous, I would almost say frightening. So I think Steve may be able to tell us now some of those principal sizes.
Well, it was an amazing project, really, the likes of which I guess I'll never ever work on again. But as you said, John, the stretcher, the power of the machine was 15,000 tons. The plate which we would have stretched was a maximum length of 36 metres, 3.3 metres wide, and 370 millimetres thick. The maximum plate weight was 25 tonnes. The machine itself weighed 4,000 tonnes, and the two moving crossheads at each end, they weighed, fully assembled, I think it was 1,000 tonnes each. The main ram diameter was 1,660 millimetres. So yes, it was a monster of a machine.
1,660 millimetres, that's in old dimensions, that's getting on for 5.5 feet. My wife could have walked up the bore of those cylinders. I'm sure she could. It's a pity it was never built. But I seem to remember that Norman Davenport, who was, he was kind of jack of all trades, he had to find out, had an order been placed, the route the huge components could take as they left a factory in, say, Sheffield. They had to be able to be safely taken by road or sea right across France by via the Mediterranean Sea and the River Rhone, and then offloaded and then taken several hundred miles through France, where they ought to do a similar exercise over there to make sure bridges were strong enough and wide enough and police escorts could be available. So it was quite a a challenge for all of us. But what about that project, Steve? Was there anything particular different about it than apart from size than the Slesine one? I'm just trying to think now whether he was there anything extra particular that we did that we hadn't done on Slesine?
Well, yes, this machine, the Slesine stretcher was a C-frame, basically, which was mounted above the bed plate, which I can't remember the reason for that design, but in many ways it's an inefficient design when it comes to the amount of metal that you need to put into the job for the strength to cope with the stresses and the power of the stretch and the machine. Where the Pechenet machine, you could never have used that type of design. So we went back to, I think it was the Diane stretcher at Kits Green, and more recent to that was the Talco stretcher from 1982, both of which were around 4,000 tons power, which were frame plates, basically. The grip jaws were strengthened with frame plates to resist the forces, and the crosshead was then built up with wings which locked either to the bed plate or was connected by clevises to the main ram, and with the forces generated by the grip action resisted by the frame plates. And on that Pechenet machine, initially it was very much a big Talco, but on investigating it and doing a lot of work, we decided the frame plates, rather than be plates, would be castings. And we visited, as I remember, not River Don, but where it had been, would have been Forge Masters, I guess, at that time, to see what the biggest castings they could produce. And I seem to remember 100 tons was a sort of reasonable limit for a single casting. So we sized the frame plates, which resisted the jaw forces, at around 100 tons. And we had three of those, rather than on the likes of other frame plate stretchers, where I think we had maybe 10 or 12.
I seem to recall, although we probably won't go into all the details now, but I seem to think the control system was much more advanced, and all the things that we had to cater for, like to make sure the stretcher didn't try and twist itself sideways, etc., etc. So the engineering of the controls was much more complex. Very interesting, though. We learned a lot, didn't we?
Yes. No, definitely. Yes, you're right. Of course, in the days when we were looking at Pechenet compared to Segedor, there were transducers that you could use and control systems, right, which could help with crabbing and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Though we did still use, initially, the Segedor grip synchronization gear, which was a mechanical means of synchronizing.
We couldn't improve on that, could we? Now, I know we travelled to France a couple of times on this job, because we were going over to a place called Issoire, just south of Clermont-Ferrand. Can you remember much about the journey, Steve?
I do. I remember it being a long journey. yes, we went through the tunnel, which was obviously open at that time. Round the Peripherique in Paris and down to Clermont-Ferrand, where we stopped, as I remember, and then travelled to Issoire, which was perhaps 30 miles further south, to visit the Pechenet, the old Segedor factory.
I think we had to show passports before we could get into the factory, didn't we? They were very security conscious.
Yes, I think you were right, yes. Yeah.
And what about the factory, Steve? That was a pretty colossal place, wasn't it? And we saw lots of the ingots being machined, didn't we?
Yes, we did. I didn't really know what they did with these big plates when they stretched them until we saw it there. and they had this what you call a gantry milling machine, where this huge plate, which might be, I don't know, 10, 15 metres long, is sat on the bed of a machine, and the gantry passes over it and mills, I think they say something like 90% of it ends up as swarf on the floor, and this is to form the main wing spar in an aircraft.
Okay, well, I think we've done covered quite a few technical aspects of working together. During the years you were at Fieldings, Steve, I understand there were no canteen facilities or no company organised social and sporting activities as there used to be in years gone by. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. We weren't as lucky as the older generation. All that had long since gone by the time that I arrived. So you either bought sandwiches or you went to the Whitesmiths and had a beer and a sandwich there.
I remember that. Do you think Fieldings were a good company to work for?
I thought so. I always consider it as probably the best time of my working life. And I'd say the reason for that is mainly, and I suppose everyone would say the same, it's the people. It's the people there that make a company. And I was lucky to work with some wonderful people who were very knowledgeable and also willing to share their knowledge and encourage you. So no, I would definitely say so.
Well said. About management, any complaints there?
I didn't really, but I just loved the company and didn't have any problems with the management.
So say all of us. Any sad moments at all, Steve, where you were there?
Well, I would almost say it was sad to see colleagues retire. Because I've made some good friends with lots of older colleagues that were coming up to retirement when I started, and then to see them retire was always a sad day. But the saddest day was really when it was announced that we were to be closed down, which I think was January 2000, as I remember. That was a very sad day.
About fondest memories, Steve.
There were so many good memories, I can't say I could pick one out.
Never mind, so we won't pick one out at all. So obviously, I think you've answered the question more or less, which was my penultimate question. When did you leave the company, and what were the reasons? Well, I think you've already mentioned the reasons. When was that, Steve? That was about 2000, was it?
Yes, well, January 2000, as I remember, they announced that they were changing, Motherwell Bridge was changing the organisation, and that most of us were going to be made redundant. Who was going to be made redundant, we didn't exactly know then. But then they started to announce who was going. They wanted to keep a few of us on in the drawing office, because we were doing a very big project for British Aluminium at that time, an extrusion handling system. So myself and two others ended up staying in the drawing office beyond about the February, March, when I think the majority of people had left. And we stayed to finish that project till about July 2000. And then we left. We were the last to leave the drawing office. But the company did continue as a sales office and sort of support office, where there was no more design engineering and no more workshop at that time.
My final question, Steve, is what do you consider was your finest achievements whilst working at Fielding and Platt? Please don't answer the question just at the moment, before I've talk to this lovely lady sitting here beside me, whose presence will be explained in due course.